Okay, so we're going to start Daniel chapter 11, and the key word is start, because there's a lot here in this chapter, and as we look at Daniel chapter 11, we've already learned in Daniel chapter 10 that, oh my goodness. Much better, Ron. Thank you. Let there be light. So we've learned that in Daniel chapter 10 that an angel has been sent by God from the throne to go and to speak with Daniel, that this angel was temporarily delayed by the prince of the kingdom of Persia. Michael the archangel had come and had taken up that little battle and allowed this angel free to come to Daniel. And what we're getting ready to look at here in Daniel chapter 11 is the revelation that this angel is giving to Daniel in regards to his people. Now, I'm going to mention a lot of names, and if I remember, I'm going to write the names up on the board so you'll get the spelling, but there's going to be a lot of name dropping. A lot of name dropping as we go, as we begin to look at chapter 11. Chapter 11 can be divided into two sections. Let me get my little cheat sheet out so I can keep up with you guys. It's divided into two sections. Daniel 11, 1 through 35 is the first section. And on your worksheet, this is the time of the Persian Empire. We're going to see the rise and fall of Alexander the Great. That's also in your blank. So, Persian Empire, rise and fall of Alexander the Great. And also what we're going to see is Alexander's kingdom being divided among his four generals, and that there's going to be a struggle between the king of the south, which is Egypt, and the king of the north, which is Syria. And both of these kingdoms are going to battle out for dominance to control Jerusalem and the promised land. And all of this history that we're getting ready to look at from Daniel chapter 11, starting in verse 1 all the way to verse 35, will be culminated in the rise of a man that we have been introduced to already, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, which is the little horn of Daniel chapter 8. And Daniel chapter 11 is going to go into yet even more detail concerning this individual that we know of as Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. So this section of Daniel between verses 1 through 35, verses 2 through 4, spans approximately 200 years, and then from 5 to 35, you can tack on maybe another 150-plus years. So what we're looking at here from Daniel 11, 1 through 35, we're looking at approximately 350-some years of history. So we're going to cover about 350 years in 35 verses. Now, again, remember, what was future to Daniel, right, is past to us. All right, so everything that Daniel is seeing is in his future, in the future of his people. And most of it is now past history to us. Section 2 of Daniel, starting with verse 36 and all the way to the end of Daniel chapter 12, this will cover the period that we know of in the book of Revelation as the 70th week of Daniel, and that's where we're going to learn about the period in which the Antichrist, and that's on your worksheet, the little horn of Daniel chapter 7 comes into power. So the last part of Daniel chapter 11 into Daniel 12 talks about the Antichrist. Now, when we get there, we'll see this. I'll try to bring this out a little more clear. But that means that between verse 35 and verse 36 of Daniel 11, there will be what we call a gap of time that will exist. Okay, a gap of time will exist between verse 35 and verse 36. Now, what do you think fits within this gap of time? Well, we're living in it right now. It's the church age. It's the church age. We're living in that gap of time between verse 35 and verse 36 of Daniel chapter 11. And of course, in the Old Testament, the church age is hidden in the Old Testament, and it's a mystery, and it hasn't been revealed until Paul reveals it in the book of Ephesians and other New Testament writings. So there is a gap of time. So it's important when you're reading through the book of Daniel. Again, I've said this many, many times. Who does the prophecy of Daniel deal primarily with? Israel. Exactly. Israel. You must keep that in mind, because if you don't keep that in mind, then you're going to insert all sorts of crazy things. So the book of Daniel is talking about Daniel's people. It's also talking about those Gentile nations that have a direct impact upon Israel. Okay, and we've seen some of these nations, Babylon, Persia, Greece, right? Rome, the revised Roman Empire. So it's very, very important that you remember that's what Daniel is dealing with. Now, what we're getting ready to look at in Daniel chapter 11 is so remarkably detailed prophetically that concerning the Persian and Greek Empire, there was a heathen philosopher, and I may have mentioned this man before. His name is Porphyrophor. That should be an H. I don't know how you pronounce it.
I think you pronounced it
Porphyry. There you go. Porphyry. Yeah, you're right. There's a Y on the end of that. Porphyry. Now, Porphyry was a skeptic who lived in the 3rd century AD. And he read the book of Daniel and he said, No, I'm not buying this. I'm not buying that Daniel was written by a man who lived back in the 6th century, because it's just too detailed to be true. It's just too detailed to be true. And so he claimed that Daniel was a 2nd century BC forgery. Now, Porphyry was sharp enough to make the correlation with history and prophecy in this chapter, because he could read this chapter and then look back in history and make the connection. He connected the dots. And he was persuaded in his own mind that there was no man alive who could possibly predict with such accuracy these events so far into the future as Daniel could back in the 6th century. And guess what? Yeah, he is. He's absolutely right. No man could do that. No man could do that. The one thing that this skeptic left out was what? God. Exactly. God would reveal to a man who lived in the 6th century these events that we're getting ready to study out. He didn't believe in that. That's why he had such a hard time struggling with this. Because what we're getting ready to look in Daniel chapter 11 is so accurate when you look back on historical fulfillment of these things, it's so accurate that it's not a wonder that a skeptic like Porphyry would say, I can't believe this is true. I can't believe this has got to be a forgery. But it's not a forgery. It is the Word of God, and we can trust in it. And we can trust in it. So let's take a look at some things. I think this is on your worksheet. I know there's a lot of preliminary stuff that I'm going through here before we get into it. But I want to talk to you about three principles of prophecy. This is on your worksheet. First of all, prophecy is accurate, but selective. Prophecy is accurate, but selective. You see, God chooses to reveal only certain elements. But those elements that he does reveal are accurate, right? So God doesn't show you all the details. And boy, we would love to have some of these details, wouldn't we? Why doesn't God tell us what color Jesus' eyes were? You know, that kind of stuff is what people go crazy about, right? So prophecy is accurate but selective. Number two, prophecy is selective in the details. Prophecy is selective in the details. Prophecy will not reveal all of the history of a particular period or all of the names of its rulers or all of the key players. Yet, the details provided assist in identifying who these key nations are, these key players are, who these key people are, because we have the benefit of history. As we look back in history, we see the fulfillment of this prophecy. I can't remember where the passage is. I think it's in Ezekiel that talks about the destruction of the city of Tyre. And it talks about Tyre being destroyed to the point where fishermen would lay out their nets upon the rock that this city sat on. Right? That came to pass. And guess what? That's what fishermen do. The city of Tyre that once was a major force in the region was leveled to the ground. And now fishermen, where this once great city was, now fishermen lay their nets out to dry. Just like prophecy said hundreds of years before it happened. Number three, prophecy is selective about the facts. Prophecy is selective about the facts. It's not possible to determine why some facts and details are given while others are not. But again, those facts that are given, you can count on them. They're true. They're true. So those are three principles of prophecy. And as we progress through Daniel 11, you're going to see these three principles pop up time and time and time again. So that's why I'm giving them to you. So that's a little bit of HBI. You know, so you can get your degree right there. All right, so let's take a look at this. Daniel chapter 11, starting in verse 1 and 2, it says, Also I in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now will I show thee the truth. This is the angel speaking to Daniel. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. So really, the predictive portion of this chapter begins right here in verse 2. Verse 1 is kind of a segue from chapter 10 into chapter 11. This is the angel talking about Michael being involved with the fallen angelic representative of Persia. But now begins the actual revelation. And the revelation given to Daniel occurred when Cyrus was the king of Persia. Okay, so Cyrus was the king of Persia. And it was Cyrus, if you remember, that God used to end the 70 years of captivity of Israel in Babylon. So Cyrus is now king. Cyrus is the one who gave the decree for the temple to be rebuilt. He gave the decree that the people were allowed to return from Babylon and to go back into Jerusalem, back into the promised land. So as we proceed through this 11th chapter of Daniel, what we're going to do is we're going to start identifying these individuals that have a major part in Israel's history. Now it says here that there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia. That's in verse 2. So since Cyrus is the current ruler of Persia, we can't really count on him, right? Because he's the one who's ruling right now. And that's what the phrase means, yet to stand up. In other words, what he's saying here is after Cyrus, there's going to be three kings that's going to come down the pipe. Okay? A lot of Persian kings have been identified, but really what fits best are the three succeeding kings. And so I'm going to give you their names. The first one is a fellow by the name of Cambyses. Cambyses. That's the first one in your sheet. The second one is a fellow by the name of Suedo Smurtus. That's a nice name. Suedo Smurtus. And then the third one is a fellow by the name of Darius the First. That sounds like an allergy. Histaspes. Gesundheit. Okay? Darius the First, Histaspes. Now this fella here would be your ruler that you read about in Ezra chapter 5 and Ezra chapter 6. Okay, so this one here, he's in power when Ezra chapter 5 and Ezra chapter 6. Ezra 5, 6 says, the copy of the letter that Tattenai, governor on this side the river, and Shethar Bozanai and his companions, the Apharsachites, man, I tell you, which were on this side of the river, sent unto Darius the king. That's who we're talking about. So that's Ezra chapter 5 and Ezra chapter 6. So these are the three kings that would follow immediately. And then it says here, there's a fourth king, and the fourth shall be richer than they all. So a fourth king is mentioned. And this fourth king is this guy, Xerxes the First. This Xerxes is also the Ahasuerus of the book of Esther. And Xerxes represented the pinnacle. The pinnacle of Persian power. The pinnacle of Persian opulence. Esther 1:1, now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 170 and 20 provinces. So under this man's rule, Persia had expanded to its utmost limits. He was fabulously wealthy. Fabulously, just like it says here in Daniel, and by his strength, through his riches, he'll stir up against the realm of Grecia. So this man was extremely wealthy, extremely powerful. And so he has this accumulated wealth, and what he did was is he put together an enormous army, over 800,000 troops. These are troops that could actually enter into the field of battle. This is not talking about the support group. We're talking actual 800,000 troops. And he took 4 years to build up this army. 4 years he took to build up this massive army. And there was a reason why he did this. And this reason was he wanted to invade what we know of as Greece or Macedonia. And he wanted to conquer Greece. And so he invaded Greece in 490 B.C. In 490 B.C. And so he rallied all of his troops and he marched into Greece to subdue him. Now, there's going to be some things on your worksheet here. Some bits of history. You can check it out if you want. So when Xerxes the First marched into Greece, he didn't have an easy time of it. First of all, he met with the defeat at the Battle of Salamis, S-A-L-A-M-I-S, Salamis, in 480 B.C. As a result, Xerxes had to retreat back into Asia, leaving a general by the name of Mardonius to attempt to conquer Greece. However, the following year, the remainder of the Persian army was defeated at a battle of Plataea, P-L-A-T-A-E-A. Again, you can go to your encyclopedias or your internet and you can find it and you can read about these battles. These are major important battles. And then finally, the Persian Navy was defeated at the Battle of Mycale, M-Y-C-A-L-E. And these three defeats squelched any further attempts by Persia to try and conquer Greece. And in fact, with him trying to take Greece, this was the beginning of the end of the Persian Empire. Because it expended so much wealth, he lost so much military might trying to defeat the Greeks. That was really the beginning of the end of the Persian Empire. And he was noted also for his cruelty. So while he was trying to defeat the Greeks, he was a very merciless combatant. And Greece never forgot it. Greece never forgot what the Persians did under Xerxes when they tried to defeat the Greeks. And that's why when Alexander the Great comes upon the scene, he was not satisfied with simply pushing the Persians out. He wanted to destroy them, and he did. In 3 years, he destroyed him. Remember when we were reading in Daniel chapter 8, verse 7 about the he-goat? And it says in Daniel 8, 7, the he-goat was moved with great choler. You remember that word, choler? That means fury. So Alexander's beef with Persia was personal. It was revenge. That's why that he-goat was said to be moved with choler, with fury. He had a vendetta that he was going to fulfill in taking out the Greeks. And again, the consistency of Daniel, the book of Daniel, in dealing with all of these nations is consistent throughout Daniel. Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. All right? So I'm thinking, if Daniel is consistent with these nations, then we should be consistent with these nations. And there are folks out there who really come up with some pretty crazy stuff. So, Daniel is very consistent with all these nations. Daniel 11:3, and a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven. And not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those. So we've already seen this before in Daniel. What the angel is revealing to Daniel is, I guess the word would be, it's not concise, because from verse 3 to 4, there's about 150 years that transpire. Okay? So sometimes we read the scriptures and we don't consider that there's any time that takes place between, you know, like say verse 3 and verse 4, but you have to keep in mind that there is some time that takes place. So about 150 years or 130 years, I got that wrong, and that should be on your sheet. Yeah, 130 years after the death of Xerxes I, Alexander the Great would appear on the scene. So about 130 years have passed. Now, also on your worksheet, his father, Philip of Macedon, became king in 338 BC. And as Philip began to expand and secure the borders of his empire, he eventually came toe-to-toe with the Persian Empire. Okay? And there was some conflict in western Turkey. Now, King Philip, which was Alexander's father, was assassinated by one of his generals. And Alexander came into power when he was 20 years old. So that would be age of 20, Alexander would take the throne. Now, where Philip only sought to secure his borders against Persia, Alexander the Great wanted revenge. And that's on your worksheet. Secure his borders and revenge. Alexander wanted revenge for what the Persians had done to the Greek people. And so he began a blitzkrieg, I guess, campaign against the Persian Empire. Now, I may have shared this story with you before, but there is a story that's recorded in the Jewish Talmud that while Alexander was on the march in defeating Persia, one of the strategic sites that he thought was important to conquer was the city of Jerusalem. So he was marching toward Jerusalem to defeat Jerusalem and to take from the temple the treasures, you know, so he could pay his troops. The Jews in Jerusalem, upon hearing the news that Alexander was on his way to conquer and sack the city, they put on sackcloth and they began fasting and praying to God for deliverance. And then the high priest sent a message back to Alexander telling him that they would surrender as well as give him a fortune in gold, but they could not remove the vessels from the temple because they were sacred unto the Lord. All right, so they were wanting to hang on to those sacred vessels in the temple. Of course, this angered Alexander. I mean, he is a conqueror. You know, what right do these people have to dictate terms to him? And so he swore an oath by his idols that not one stone would lay upon another. He would go and flatten the city of Jerusalem. He was a hothead. He was a hothead. But during the night, Alexander had a dream. And an angel came with a drawn sword in his hand, and he warned Alexander not to destroy the city of God, nor harm the people of Jerusalem. When Alexander and his army arrived at Jerusalem, a high priest by the name of Anani met him at the city gate, accompanied by 80 priests dressed in their priestly garments. And they came to beg Alexander to spare the city. When Alexander saw the high priest, to the amazement of his troops, he got off his horse and bowed on his face before the high priest. And his troops were just beside themselves. And so they demanded of Alexander, "Why in the world did you do this?" And he says, "In my dream, I dreamt an angel with a drawn sword, and the angel looked exactly like the high priest." He looked exactly like the high priest. And so what the high priest did was he brought Alexander into the city and brought him to the temple, laid out the scroll, and showed him in the book of Daniel where Alexander was going to conquer Persia. And because the priest showed Alexander what the scripture said that he was going to do, that he was going to conquer Persia, Alexander spared the city. Alexander spared the city. That's a pretty neat story. That's a pretty neat story. So with the skill of his Macedonian cavalry and the discipline of his troops, it took Alexander 3 years to defeat this Persian empire. Now it says here in verse 4, "When he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside those." And we've already seen something like this in Daniel chapter 8. In Daniel chapter 8, verse 8, it says, "Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven." Again, we see the consistency of Daniel throughout. And so at the height of his power, Alexander died at the age of 33. And then his generals shortly thereafter began to divide his empire up into four different sections. Alexander's only living heir was just a small child, was assassinated by his enemies. I think the boy was only like 2 or 3 years old. And so they assassinated the little boy. So no living heir of Alexander, came to the throne. And we've already looked at it. I mentioned that there was a fellow by the name of Cassander that went to the west, Lysimachus to the north, Seleucus to the east, and a fellow by the name of Ptolemy to the south. And so there you have the four winds of heaven. So Alexander's kingdom was divided up into four sections by his four generals. Again, this is stuff that you can go to and read about in history books or encyclopedias or wherever it is that you get your information. Now, we've also talked a little bit about Alexander's conquest and his influence upon that part of the world, and how that the Greek influence was to become one of the Jews' greatest dangers in regards to their existence, kind of like when Israel was in captivity in Egypt, right? And the Pharaoh wanted to kill all the male children. There was a very similar threat with the Greek philosophy. Are you too cold? But there was a similar threat with the Greek philosophy to the Jews. And their philosophy was very influential among the elites, the rich, and among the young people. So the young people and the rich and the elite were buying into this Greek philosophy. And they were rejecting that old-time religion. Does that not sound familiar? It's kind of what's going on today. It's kind of what's going on today. So, I can't remember the guy's name. He wrote a real famous history of the world. He'll come to me in a minute. But he described Alexander's conquest of the Persian Empire. And this might date me, and some of you may not understand what I'm saying here. But he said it was like someone had picked up the needle off the phonograph and put it in an entirely new groove. That's how much of a change occurred in the world when Alexander conquered the Persian Empire. The world shifted into a new paradigm, into a new groove. Now, with this paradigm shift, Alexander established a very important port city in Egypt. Guess what the name of that city is called? Come on. Alexandria. Yeah. I mean, if I'm going to found a city and I'm an egotistical maniac, I'm going to name it after myself. So, yeah, there was a famous port city called Alexandria. And in the city of Alexandria, Greek culture would just flourish. And it would become a destructive philosophical influence upon the Jewish people. It was a mecca of learning. Okay, it was a mecca of learning. And it was there in Alexandria that the Jews would assimilate Greek philosophy into their religion. And it was the mingling of these two cultures that the Septuagint was born. Now, if you paid attention to Randy Foster's teaching on the Word of God, the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew texts. So that's when they started getting away from the original texts as far as their Bible is concerned, and they started reading the Septuagint or the Greek text as far as our Hebrew scriptures is concerned. And if you've read any modern commentaries, instead of quoting or referring to the Masoretic text, which is the original Hebrew text, they'll always quote the Septuagint, because the Septuagint is modern translation, if you will, of the old Hebrew text. Not unlike what a lot of folks are doing today with the New Testament. A fellow by the name of Philo, a Hellenistic Jewish philosopher who lived in Alexandria, Egypt, during the Roman Empire, introduced the allegorical method of interpreting Scripture. That's where you spiritualize everything. You spiritualize everything. And he would make an allegory out of the Scriptures. And his reason for doing so was because he felt that the common man was too ignorant to understand his Bible. And so he needed the assistance of the educated to help him understand his Bible. Does that not sound familiar? This Philo had a great influence upon fellows by the name of Clement, Origen, Augustine, and all of these men are thought to be fathers of the church. Fathers of the church, who greatly influenced what we know of today as Roman Catholicism. Okay? So that's where the Greek influences come in. And it simply is a means to undermine the authority of the Word of God and elevate the teachings of men. And it was this Hellenistic influence that the Jews would have to face, and it would be the greatest threat that they would face. And we're going to see this as they sought to get away from worshiping Jehovah, the old-time religion. The old-time religion. Not much different than what the church faces with the Gnosticism. You ever heard Gnosticism? And all the other isms out there? Well, guess where it came from? Okay, so now as we look at this, in Daniel 11:5, we start seeing a shift. Okay, and I think that's in your... Yeah, Daniel's prophecy now takes an abrupt shift in focus. So we're leaving general history of empires grappling for control like the Persia and Greek, and now we're going to get a little more specific. I love what this one guy said. As you study this prophecy, it's kind of like having a microscope. You know, on the bottom of the microscope, it's got different magnifications. As you get in closer, you flip that little thing and you get a higher magnification. And then you flip that little thing and you get a higher magnification. That's what we're getting ready to do here in Daniel chapter 11. We're starting to scope down in magnification as we zero in on a particular individual. Okay? Does that make sense? You guys kind of looking at me like, it'll make sense. You'll see, it'll start making sense. Okay, so, let me see on your sheet. I don't want to... So we have Alexander's kingdom divided up into four kingdoms, but there's only two kingdoms that were now. Okay, so now we flip the microscope, and now these two kingdoms are what we are observing in greater detail. Oh, that's a U. The first one is Seleucus, and the other one is Ptolemy. Those are two generals. Seleucus would be Syria. Ptolemy would be, I always misspell Egypt. I think it's E-G-Y-P-T. Okay. So Seleucus represents Syria, and Ptolemy represents Egypt. Again, we're only looking at those niche nations that have a direct impact upon Israel. All right? God's chosen people. So as we begin to look deeper into Daniel chapter 11, what's going to begin to unfold is that there's going to be a power struggle between these two households. There's going to be a power struggle between these two households, these two kings. They're also called the king of the south and the king of the north. And you'll read that in Daniel chapter 11 too. King of the south, king of the north. And that's what it's talking about. It's talking about the household of the Seleucus and the household of Ptolemy, or Syria and Egypt. Daniel 11:8. Is it Daniel 11:8? Yeah, king of the north is mentioned. Okay. So in Daniel 11:8, we learn that the king of the south is Egypt, and the king of the north would later become known as Syria. Again, remember, in Daniel's day, Syria did not exist yet. Okay, but we know it as Syria because of history. Again, that's another internal evidence that Daniel was written in the 6th century. Because if Daniel was written in the 2nd century, like this fellow thought it was, would not that Daniel know of Syria? Would not that Daniel use the name of the country Syria? But since Daniel lived in the 6th century and Syria was not in existence at the time, then he wouldn't use Syria because it wasn't in existence. Does that make sense? So that's kind of internal evidence as far as Daniel is concerned. So Daniel didn't know that Syria was in existence, but we do now. Again, that's prophecy is selective in the details. So we read here in verse 5, "And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion." So we read about a particular king of the south here in verse 5 who will be strong, which means he'll prevail, and how that one of his princes will prevail or be strong above him or above or over and above him. And what we begin to see in this verse is the what one guy called the germ seed of the struggle. This is the beginning of the struggle between these two houses over Israel and over Jerusalem. So here's some names, okay? The king of the south is known in history as Ptolemy the First Soter. Ptolemy the First Soter. Okay. He was one of Alexander's most capable generals. And when they started dividing things up, he said, "I want Egypt." And so he took Egypt. He took Egypt. This fella here reigned in Egypt from 321 B.C. to 285 B.C. And then 305 B.C. is when he declared himself king. And also in your, it was the, you could call this the Ptolemy dynasty. The Ptolemy dynasty. That lasted the longest among the four. In fact, it lasted all the way up until Rome took over. Remember Mark Antony and all that kind of stuff? That's part of this dynasty. Ptolemy the First was also the fellow who was the one who took control of Jerusalem. And he did this on the Sabbath day because he knew the Jews wouldn't what? Wouldn't fight on the Sabbath. So while the Jews were observing the Sabbath, he and his forces marched right into Jerusalem and claimed it. Easy battle. Then there's a fellow by the name of Seleucus First Nicator. That should be a C. This man was a general in this man's army. Okay? He was also a general in Alexander's army, and he was also a general in Ptolemy's army. What he tried to do, as everybody was dividing up their piece of the pie, this guy wanted to take over Babylon. He wanted that part of Alexander's kingdom. But a fellow by the name of Antigonus challenged him and chased him out of Babylon, and so he joined forces with Ptolemy. Okay? He joined forces with Ptolemy. And so he went to Ptolemy for refuge. And that's why it refers to him and Daniel as a prince of this man. He's one of the princes of this man. In time, while commanding, while under this man's rule and in charge of this man's army, he takes this man's army and he goes back up to Babylon. And he defeats Antigonus and claims the Babylonian territory for himself. Okay, so what he wasn't able to do in the first place, he went back and defeated him in the second chance. And that's what it means in Daniel 11:5, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion, and his dominion shall be a great dominion. And indeed, this man's dominion was greater than this one because he only ruled Egypt, but this guy ruled all the way to India. All of that territory that was one time Babylonian Empire, he now had control of. So definitely his dominion was greater. And even though the Ptolemy dynasty would have control over Jerusalem for about 100 years, it was this household that it eventually would take over. Okay, Daniel 11:6. And in the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm. But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. So, chronologically, some 31 years have expired between verse 5 and verse 6. These guys were battling back and forth. And there was an attempt to make peace. Ptolemy wanted to make peace. He was tired of war. He wanted to make peace. Well, this fella had died, and so another Ptolemy had taken his place, and his name was Ptolemy Philadelphus. Lots of names, guys. Ptolemy the Second Philadelphus. And this fellow took over from this guy. His name was Antiochus. Lots of names. The Second Theosis. Okay? He was the grandson of this fellow. And these two kings became rivals. They began to fight with one another over control of territory. And so the house Ptolemy, they still had control over Jerusalem. They still had control over the Promised Land. That was a very strategic piece of real estate. But he was getting tired of it. Ptolemy Philadelphus was getting tired of it. And so he gave his daughter, and this is in your worksheet, and I think they pronounce her name, we might pronounce it Bernice. Yeah. We would pronounce it Bernice, wouldn't we? But I think the history, they call it Bernice, something like that. So I don't know if there's an accent on that E or what that is. Anyway, she was offered by Ptolemy Philadelphus to this fellow to marry. That's what it means. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. So Bernice would be the gal right there in your worksheet. But there was a catch. Ptolemy not only offered this gal's hand in marriage, but he also promised to give this guy a big dowry. And so he had a nickname among the people called Phrenophorus, which means dowry giver. So he was very earnest in wanting to make peace between these two households. But there was a catch. And the catch was this. This guy here was already married to a lady by the name of Laodicea. And this is the catch. Antiochus had to agree to divorce his former wife, Laodicea, disinherit his two sons from the throne of the house of the Seleucus. And if there was a son born to he and Bernice, then that son would be the rightful heir to this throne. Pretty sharp, isn't it? Kind of a little mini Game of Thrones going on there. Right? Not only would this guy ensure peace, but he would also have one of his descendants sitting on the throne of the rival house. So it was really a win-win situation for this guy, if Antiochus agreed to it. And he did, because money talks, right? Money talks. And so Antiochus accepted the deal, and this Ptolemy accompanied his daughter along with this huge dowry. Antiochus divorced his wife, disowned his two sons. But what did the angel tell Daniel? It says here, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. So what happened? Well, this sounds like something right out of Hollywood. This is what happened. Antiochus and Bernice did produce a son. But after about 2 years, Ptolemy, her father, dies. Okay? Her father dies. And so what does Antiochus do? He dumps Bernice. Right? Her father died. So he dumps Bernice, and he remarries his former wife, Laodicea. Now, Laodicea, not trusting her fickle husband, who can blame her? And dreading something possibly worse than divorce the next time someone comes to her husband with a good deal, what does she do? She poisons her husband, kills him, and then kills Bernice and the boy, and all of her entourage that came with her. So she just wiped out the competition. She wipes out the competition. Yeah. So not only is the struggle for control over Jerusalem the pleasant now a land, it's now become it's in your worksheet, a blood feud. It's now become a blood feud. So instead of just two households trying to gain control, it's now a Hatfield and McCoy situation. between these two houses. Just as the angel told Daniel it was going to come about. Okay. Oops, more names. More names. Daniel 11:7. But out of the branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north and shall deal against them and shall prevail and shall also carry captives into Egypt, their gods with their princes and with their precious vessels of silver and of gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. So this conflict continues between the king of the south and the king of the north. And the two major players are now these two guys. And that is, yeah. So again, Ptolemy, that's always the first part of their name. A fellow by the name of Ptolemy these names. I'm glad we have names like Larry and Jeff. Now, his name sounds like something after you've had a bad meal. Eurygertes. So Ptolemy III, Eurygertes, is the brother of Bernice. Right, so that's the phrase in verse 7, out of the branch of her roots, right, out of her family tree, this fellow shows up, that signifies lineage. Then you have, again, Seleucus being the first part of his name, Seleucus the second, C-A-L-L-I-N-I-C-U-S. Callinicus. He is the son of Antiochus by Laodicea. Remember, Laodicea poisoned her husband. And he was one of the two boys that Antiochus was supposed to disinherit. Well, he comes into power. And I think this is on your... sheet, he comes into power and he attempts a counterattack on the king of the south, but he's defeated. That's what it says in verse 10, but his son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through, then he shall return and be stirred up even to his fortress. And that's exactly what took place. He tried to counterattack the king of the south, but he was defeated and driven back to his own country. Then Daniel 11:10, I just read it, but his sons shall be stirred up, shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return to be stirred up even to his fortress. So now we're going to focus on this household right here. And this man had two boys. This man had two sons. One of his sons, and it's right there in your worksheet, so I'm not even going to write it up. Seleucus III, Saraunus. And then he had a younger boy by the name of this. This is his name. Antiochus III. That's on your worksheet. He was also come to be known as Antiochus the Great. Now the older boy, this Seleucus Callinicus or whatever his name is, he was killed in battle. He only reigned for about 2 years, and then his younger brother Antiochus III, he became king, and he was about 18 years of age when he became king. And it was this man that would bring the Seleucus dynasty to its height. All right, so he was going to bring his household to its height as far as power and everything else. So after the death of his older brother, Antiochus III, he launches a campaign against the king of the south. In approximately 217 BC, he was successful in pushing the Egyptian forces back to their fortress in Gaza. That's what it means there, that he shall be stirred up even to his fortress. So the king of the south's fortress in Gaza, that's on your worksheet. That's what he did. And it was these two boys of Seleucus Callinicus that assembled a multitude of great forces. In Daniel 11:11, it says, "And the king of the south shall be moved with choler." Remember the word choler? What does that mean? Fury. Angry. Road rage type of stuff. "And the king of the south shall be moved with choler and shall come forth and fight with him. Even the king of the north, and he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand." So by this time, there's a new Egyptian king. And his name is it on your sheet? Yep. Ptolemy the IV. Philopater. Philopater. That'd be my guess. And then Antiochus III, on your worksheet, suffered a horrific defeat. In fact, he himself was almost captured and killed. Both armies placed about 70,000 men on the field of battle. And it was Antiochus that was defeated. He had an estimated 10,000 infantry killed. 300 cavalry killed, some 4,000 troops taken. So he was pretty much decimated by the king of the south, or Ptolemy. Now, Ptolemy, on your worksheet, he had a great opportunity to soundly defeat the Syrian army. That great opportunity. But history books inform us that Ptolemy the IV is what we would term an effeminate man. An effeminate man. In other words, he was a type of individual who was very self-indulgent. He liked to wear fancy clothes. You know, genteel. Genteel man. So he really didn't have the stomach for war. And so therefore, Ptolemy the IV lacked the resolve to win complete victory. That's what it means there in verse 12. "When he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it." In other words, he didn't take advantage of his victory like he could have. Now, Ptolemy the IV and his wife died in 203 BC, and they left their 4-year-old boy on the throne. And his name was Ptolemy the V. So in 2003, Ptolemy the IV and his wife died, leaving their 4-year-old son on the throne. Ptolemy the V. Epiphanes is his name. Ptolemy the V, Epiphanes. A lot of names. So after Ptolemy the IV was defeated, Antiochus the III, he hurried home. Or Ptolemy the IV hurried home, buried himself in luxury and decadence, and I think that's what shorten his life. And there was about 12 years of peace that take place. But in the meantime, while all this was going on, Antiochus III was busy revamping his army. He had revenge in his mind. And so 12 years after his defeat, it's on your worksheet. I'm just trying to keep up with your worksheet. 12 years after his defeat by Ptolemy IV, Antiochus the Great returned with a much larger and better equipped army than before. Okay? So he spent all those years getting his army ready so that he could go back and retake that land or take that land away from the king of the south. Okay. I'm just kind of debating if I should keep going here. Is all this nice and boring? It's all history. And this is the fascinating thing about this, guys. It's what to Daniel was future, right? To us is now history. And everything that the angel told Daniel up to this point has been fulfilled. Now, what does that tell us about that which is yet to be fulfilled? It will be fulfilled, right? It will be fulfilled. That's why I find this stuff, well, I'm one of those weird cases. I like history. Not a lot of folks like history, but I like history. It's fascinating. So anyway, that's my little sidebar. I think I'm going to have to stop right there. I hate to do that, but I'm not really sure a good place to stop. Yeah, I better stop right there. Okay, so any questions on anything that we covered?
Just a comment.
Yes.
When we read, not only here, but a lot of other places where these children, like this one, 4 years old, became king, they had to have had people who acted as king because they couldn't do it.
Exactly. And in every case, almost in every case, what you have is you've got people who are supposed to be counselors and helpers of these young men and women who are on the throne, but really what do? And they take advantage of it. And that's exactly what we're going to see take place in these situations. And that is unfortunate, but it is a fact of life, isn't it? I mean, we see that... You can read through the history of England, and you discover the very same thing about people trying to take advantage of these young monarchs. And so that's the case is true here. In fact, we're going to find out that this little four-year-old boy, because he's sitting on the throne, this is the reason why Antiochus is encouraged to, hey, I'm going to go and I'm going to attack, because all they have is a four-year-old on the throne, which in his thinking... You know, that means that government is not as stable as if it were a full-grown man that was calling the shots. So he knows that there's counselors who are, I'm jumping ahead now. He knows that there's counselors with this young man who are not on the same page. And so he's going to take advantage of that instability and try to take over that piece of real estate. Well, like I said, this guy here, yeah, this guy here, all he cared about was partying and self-indulgence. And so like many, many rulers, all they're thinking about is the here and now. They're not thinking about their legacy or what's going to happen. It's all about me, isn't it? Yeah, it's all about me. So human nature is the same. Did you have a question?
Yeah, the last one on page two.
Last one on page two. On page The very last one on page 2. Better equipped. Okay, let me find it. See, I don't have 2. I have page 19. Can you read it again?
In Daniel 11:5, we see the beginning of that one blank house over the promised land. It's got the 2 little blue boxes on it.
Rival. 2 rival houses over the promised land. And those 2 rival houses are the Seleucus household and the Ptolemy household. Yeah. Okay. So we stopped in Daniel 11:13. Okay. So let me make note of that. I apologize, guys. I don't want to go through this because there's so much there. But I'm telling you, I'm only giving you a third. Okay? I'm only giving you a third. So it's taken some time, and I apologize for that, but I want you to see the accuracy of prophetic scripture. Because to me, it bolsters my faith. And if these things had come to pass, then everything that's promised to come to pass tells me it's going to come to pass. And that's what builds up my faith. And I'm hoping to do the same for you folks. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. So if there aren't any other questions, then I guess we can close in prayer and you guys are free to move about the country. It's okay? Jared West, I'm going to pick on you.